Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you Arnab sir and Kulkarni ji for going with me through all the slides time and again. Good afternoon to all of you. So I'll basically be describing about what I've been doing apart from my work in TIFR, but of course what you see right now is one of the Milky Way shots I have taken from a fully lit area near Shirdi. So what I would like to tell you is that definitely for night sky observations, you definitely need good dark skies. But with astrophotography techniques, you can actually manage to get some great objects even in light polluted cities like Mumbai. So I'll show you some of the images about, yeah, so I'll be talking about more, the slides are getting cropped actually.
Just change the resolution.
First slide.
Excuse me.
Is
So I'll be describing in short about what processes I use. It's more of, at one point it becomes more of an art than a science about making, like, beautifying your images. So this is one of the images that I have taken right here on from TIFR Terrace, C Block Terrace, that is Pleiades Open Cluster. This has been taken from a 11-inch Cassegrain telescope that we have. And you can see that even from a sky which is really light polluted, Mumbai sky is completely light polluted, in spite of that, you can actually get good images. Another image that I have taken from the same place, again TIFR, is the Andromeda Galaxy, from again from the same 11-inch Cassegrain telescope. And you might be wondering what these settings are. Of course, they are the camera settings. I'll come to those the details of those settings little later in my talk. One more image that I have taken, again this is not from Mumbai, but again a completely light polluted area. This has been taken from a simple 5-inch telescope, the image of Jupiter. And again, the Milky Way shot from the seashore of TIFR. You can see the Pelotron building here. And yes, you can actually, with little patience and little hard work, or you can say more of time effort that you need to put in, you can actually end up getting good images. So what I'll be dealing today is just a rough sketch of it, that I'll be talking more about capturing the image. Then of course, after capturing, it's about processing the image. Then what sort of camera parameters that you require, what sort of mounts that you require, how do you stack different types of images, like there's a difference in stacking your deep sky objects, there's a difference in stacking your planetary objects and so on. And I'll of course discuss some of the processing tools. What I mainly use is of course Photoshop, but then there are many processing tools that are available. So what are the basic requirements? Of course, the right camera, and of course the right mounts. And after you take the images, you need the right softwares or right methods to process your taken image. So what type of cameras that you choose? Of course, many of us, or rather most of us, will be having point and shoot cameras. They are good, no doubt, for daytime photography or land photography, I would say. But when it comes to astrophotography, point and shoot are not really a good option. DSLRs, yes, I'll be concentrating on DSLRs because they are available to us very easily, and at the same time, they are one of the most suitable choice of camera that you can use. Webcams, yes, for certain photographs, you can even use webcams. And astronomical CCD cameras are of course the best ones, but I'll come to that. They are not really a good choice when it comes to amateur astrophotography. What are the important parameters that you have to deal with when you go for photography? Of course, the shutter speed, aperture, sensitivity, and the focal length. I'll describe each one in detail later. So talking of point and shoot cameras, they are inexpensive, all of us have, but the biggest problem with point and shoot cameras are you cannot replace your lens. That becomes troublesome when you are dealing with an astrophotograph which you have to take through a telescope. So attaching your point and shoot camera to a telescope is really a pain. Another thing is most of the modes in point and shoot camera are automatic. The trouble comes when you have to focus in low light conditions and your camera keeps searching objects, some bright objects to focus, and you end up exhausting your battery. Okay, so that is a big issue. So for an astrophotograph, it is always better to go for a manual focus than using the autofocus mode in a point and shoot camera. Talking about DSLRs, it's one of the best options, as I have told you. One is because whatever you see through the viewfinder is the same thing that gets captured on your sensor. That is one thing. The idea of a DSLR is that uses single lens, and you have a mirror here which actually focuses your image onto your viewfinder. And once you press the shutter, this mirror falls off from this position and the image is formed on the sensor. So it's a single lens that actually gives you an image in your viewfinder as well as forms the same image on the sensor. So that is really a good idea because you actually see what frame you are going to capture. Okay, apart from that, a few more advantages of DSLRs is there's something known as bulb settings. It is basically your shutter speed or the exposure timings that you use apart from the predefined times that you have in your camera. Then ISO, that is basically the sensitivity of your sensor, you can easily change it, which you cannot do generally in a point and shoot camera. Then of course photo quality is much better any time than this point and shoot. You can change your lenses, and that is really a great advantage. Secondly, you end up with a raw image. So what happens in a point and shoot, you generally get an image in a JPEG, that is 8-bit formats. With your DSLRs, you can have the actual raw images which you can play with later and get out much more data than what you get in a normal JPEG image. Disadvantages, many of the cameras now, the old DSLRs did not have this facility, but many of the cameras now actually have a IR blocking filter, which actually sort of blocks your red tone in your image, which can be a troublesome thing in your this. Another thing is high power consumption. If you have to really do astrophotography throughout the night, you have to have 3 batteries in spare. That is the minimum requirement, because otherwise you will exhaust your batteries, and that's it, end of your work for that day. Webcams, yes, it's one of the choices that you can use, but the issues with webcam is the sensor is very tiny, there are no bulb exposures possible. Again, you need a computer, which can become a problem if you are really traveling to a remote place, and then you might not even have a supply or anything, a power supply to use a computer. And secondly, connecting it to a telescope is troublesome, and at the same time, without a telescope, you cannot really use a webcam. You will not get a good quality image. But generally, people use webcam for planetary photography than any other deep sky objects. Then astronomical CCDs are one of the best things that you can use for an astrophotograph. But the problem is, at amateur level, most important problem that comes with astronomical CCDs, they are very expensive. You cannot afford to buy one. And secondly, handling can be complex at times. What you have is a monochrome sensor in an astronomical CCD that which deals with light intensity rather than the color. So if you want to have some colorful shots, you have to actually use filters of different colors and take multiple shots and then work on it. So that can become troublesome. Again, computer is required. But the advantages are like great, you have a low noise because you can actually use your sensors. So that is really a good idea. You actually get a true raw data, you have good resolution, you have good sensitivity, spectral sensitivity, and of course the maximum image quality. So this was about choosing your right cameras, and I would go for definitely for a DSLR. So another thing which I mentioned was actually to use your camera in manual mode. Now why is something you can see here. This this photograph has been taken with exposures chosen by the camera, that is the auto mode, and this is something that you choose, the exposures that you choose, and you can see the difference yourself. This particular image has been totally overexposed, but if you want to get the right colors or the right quality of the image, then you have to definitely go for manual settings. Same thing has happened here. This particular image in the auto mode has been underexposed, but this is what you choose in a manual mode. So this is just to show you what happens if you actually go for auto mode every time. So dealing with a few parameters. So aperture is nothing but what is the opening in your lens, and how much light you allow to pass through that opening is the aperture size of your camera. So you can see these images here. So and generally it is defined by f-stops. So f1.4 means maximum aperture, your entire lens is exposed, whereas f16 is basically your minimum aperture. So this opening that you see here is actually the aperture of the camera. And with this image it is very much clear that larger aperture definitely going to give you much brighter images than the smaller apertures. Another parameter, the most important parameter, is of course the shutter speed, that is the time duration for which your shutter or that opening, the aperture, remains open. Okay, so that is your shutter speed, and again you can see the effects of what happens. So generally it is given by such values like 1/500, that means your shutter is going to remain open for 1/500 seconds. So that is the idea. So you can see at different exposure settings or different shutter speed settings, you can see here, this is the image of a flame where you can actually see different colors, whereas if you go for some say 1/2 or that is half a second exposure, then the entire flame is overexposed. So this is the idea of shutter speed. Another effect that you can create with shutter speed is if the object is in motion. So if you want to freeze a frame, suppose the object is in motion, you want to freeze a frame, you generally go for low shutter speed. Okay, you go for, like, you can see it, and this is an image of a pinwheel where it's been taken at 1 by 160 seconds. So you can actually see the individual spokes. But if you go for, say, higher shutter speed, that is 1 second, then you are actually going to blur out the motion. So that is in some artistic effect that you can add to your image by different shutter speeds. So showing you the difference what happens in an astronomical image. So this particular image I have taken from Ladakh, and this set of images, of course these are stack images, this set of images has been taken at 15 second exposure. So total 25 frames of 15 second exposure stacked together. I'll talk about stacking a little later, which gives me a total exposure of 6.25 minutes. Whereas this particular image has been taken with a shutter speed of 30 seconds, same 25 frames, which gives me a double exposure time, and you can see the difference yourself in the Milky Way. So I mentioned about bulb settings. So talking about shutter speed, every DSLR limits the predefined shutter speed that is, so it has.
Do you know what CCD was in that camera?
This one? ISO, yeah. It's a Canon 600D camera that I'm using. So it's been taken with that particular. Talking about this 6400, actually that has been taken from a Nubra Valley, which is really a colder place. So if you try to take it from Mumbai, then I'll definitely have a noisy this. But the idea that the relatively cooler area, I could go up to 6400 ISO. Yeah. So I'll come to that later. So about bulb setting, so any of the camera has got a maximum shutter speed, predefined shutter speed is 30 seconds. So if you want to go for a shutter speed more than that, which generally you require in most of the astronomical images, then there is something known as bulb setting, in which as long as the shutter is pressed, your camera, your sensor will be gathering light. So that is a sort of a manual shutter speed that you can choose. And of course, but that doesn't mean that you have to continuously hold your camera and keep taking images. There are other softwares, or you can even do through a remote control. There are many other softwares which actually allow you to take exposures of more than 30 seconds. Talking about sensitivity, this is just an added thing to your shutter speed, which can actually give you much brighter images. So once you reach a limit of your shutter speed, or you, it's not only about sometimes you have to limit your shutter speed depending upon Earth's rotation as well. So at that point, what you need to do is, if you want some more added brightness, you simply increase the sensitivity of your sensors. So that will, you can see the effect here. So at ISO 400 and ISO 3200, you can see that it has brightened up, the image has brightened up. So this simply increases the sensitivity of your sensors, and that gives you an added brightness to your image. But another thing that it does, along with increasing the sensitivity, is that it can actually make your image noisy. So generally you have to optimize your settings with right shutter speed and right sensitivity, so that you can get an image which is bright enough, but it's not too noisy. So as I was just telling, so if I'm trying to, if I'm taking images from Mumbai, then I generally do not go for ISOs which are about 3200, unless you have, like, you're working in winter or anything, because the minute you go for like high temperatures, your sensor will not work that well as much as it works in the cooler this. So if you go, like, when I was in Ladakh, I actually experimented with 6400. I was actually getting good images, what I generally get for like 1600 and 3200 in Mumbai. So that matters a lot. Yeah. Yeah, that matters a lot. Temperature, because I'll come to that later, but the physical temperature also matters a lot. So coming up, what we get is, this is the effects of aperture, generally that you get. This is what happens when you change the shutter speed, and this is what happens when you change your ISO. So these are basic camera settings that you require to know before going for any kind of photography. It's not only about astrophotography, but any kind of photography. Apart from that, there is one more feature that most of the DSLRs have, and that is metering. So once you talk about deep sky objects, this is a useless thing. You don't really get the correct values. But if you are going for something like moon, okay, which is bright enough, moon, or even for that matter eclipses, okay, so which is bright enough, but you don't know, like once you take a photograph, you don't know at what settings you need to take. So generally your camera actually helps you in choosing the settings, is that if this needle, a particular this needle shows you around -3, it shows that your image is going to be underexposed. If it is pointing towards +3, it will tell you that your image is overexposed. So you try and adjust it near zero with whatever these settings of your shutter speed, aperture and ISO, you try and adjust this needle to zero, and that will give you good settings for basically will tell you an optimized settings for a good image. Okay, but of course, as I told you, this doesn't work with deep sky objects. If the object is relatively bright, then this method works, or for daytime photography this method works, but otherwise yeah. Yeah.
Is the
metering really useful as opposed to just looking at the image, because that, or the live image is not corresponds to the exposure settings? Live image, well, I have never checked with the live image, but what you see with the viewfinder, you can,
if you're looking directly through the viewfinder, you don't know how.
No, you can actually change the settings looking through the viewfinder. Yeah, so. Comparing with the LCD display, I'm not too sure whether it will actually give me it will actually display what the image has been taken.
No, it won't.
It won't, yeah, it won't actually.
I think it does something different.
Okay. So another factor that can affect your image is, of course, the magnification that you get due to the focal length of the lens that you use. So for DSLRs, we have this variable focal length lenses, that is the common kit lens that you get is of course the 18mm 55mm focal length lens, and for further magnification the zoom lens you can use, like there are various available like from 55 to 250 or even to 300 and 350, and there are many lenses actually available. Of course the cost goes on increasing as you try to buy higher magnification lenses, but yeah, so the idea is shorter the focal length, you're going to get a wide angle view, longer the focal length you are going to get basically a zoomed up or the magnified view, the field of view. And to show you an example, I have clicked Orion Nebula. This is at different focal length, so this is 18mm where I can see the entire Orion constellation. This has been Orion Nebula has been taken at 250mm and this has been taken at 400mm, so you yourself can see the difference in the magnification and the field of view, that what happens to an image. So generally when I talk about Milky Ways, I definitely go for the shortest focal length because I want the entire region to be covered, so I have taken most of the Milky Way images at 18mm. What troubles us the most is the Earth's rotation, of course. So, so there are various ways of avoiding that. One is, if you are really going for a wide angle photography, then you can actually go for a large shutter speed, large as in of course up to 30 seconds or something, without getting such trails. But if you are actually going for a higher focal length, that is magnified image, then you really need to have some tracking mounts. Without that, all your images will be trailed like this. So this has been purposely taken. This is only to this has been purposely taken to trail the stars. It's been stacked that way that you actually see the trails, and this actually tells you how the Earth is actually rotating. This image has been taken from Raigad Fort. So to avoid this trailing, you have to actually choose the right mounts. The simplest mount that you can use is your normal camera tripod. Again, as I mentioned, at 18mm, if you go, which I generally use for Milky Way photography, then you don't need any tracking mount. A simple tripod is enough, and you go up to 30 seconds, your trails won't, I wouldn't say that there are no trails, they are not that visible at 18mm, whatever field of view that you get. So this is some, so you can use a normal tripod with two or three axes, which will help you to adjust the exact area in the sky, and you can take images straight away. Another option is you can use a telescope, mount your camera like this to your telescope, that is your eyepiece holder, and take photographs. But in this case, you have to have a tracking mount, otherwise whatever shutter speeds you give will be really low. So with even at 250mm, if I go for more than 1 second shutter speed, then I'm going to get trails. So that is the idea. So if you have to go for a magnified view, then tracking mounts is must. So another problem sometimes that happens with mounting your camera to Newtonian type of telescopes is generally your telescope, Newtonian type of telescope, focuses inside the eyepiece holder. So when you directly attach a camera without a lens to a Newtonian telescope, you do not get focused images. So then you have to actually play along, use Barlow's, or you know, play along and try to take. So generally what we have done is we remove the mirror, the primary mirror, fit it somewhere closer distance to the secondary mirror, and then try to focus the images. So that is one thing you can do, or play along. Like for planetary photography, what I do is I use a Barlow. I put a Barlow here. Barlow is just a concave lens which actually extends your focal length and magnifies more. Okay, and then attach a camera to it so that you can get good images. For attaching, you have these T-rings and T-adapters which are again camera specific. Every camera model will have a different, like the Nikon cameras have different T-rings and Canon and so forth. So everyone will have. The best one I always prefer for astrophotography is a refractor telescope than a reflector one, unless you have something like Cassegrain or Maksutov where you can adjust the focal length by changing the distance of your primary mirror straight away. But refracting lenses is, refracting telescopes are anytime better for astrophotography than reflecting ones. Good quality ones you don't generally, the one which I use is a Skywatcher, this which is pretty decent enough, like it doesn't give me that much of chromatic aberration as, so it actually depends upon the quality of your refracting one. But it's much easier to work with the refracting than the reflector, otherwise you'll have to play along adjusting the focal length, which becomes sometimes a problem. Okay, another way you can actually mount your camera is directly mount it on the top of the telescope. This of course does not give you the added advantage of magnifying your image, so you have to use your camera lens for that. But what it does is it actually helps you to locate the image very easily in the sky. So what you do is you generally align your camera along with the telescope and try to find the image in the telescope, which will automatically be in the field of view of the camera. So that actually this arrangement is known as piggyback arrangement, and this actually helps you to locate objects very easily, which generally you cannot find directly from the camera because you don't see most of the object directly on the screen of the camera, so you don't know where you're pointing. So this way actually helps you locate the objects very easily. And the idea of tracking mount is this again. So if you go for the same thing which I told you before, so at 30 seconds exposure will not give you trails at 18 mm, but this particular image you can see has been taken at for every this you will require tracking if you have to go for. Yeah. You can, but again you have to align your camera, I mean your cell to exact.
You can attach your mobile.
Yeah, you can do that. That can be done. That is one way of doing, definitely. But if there is really a faint object or you want to exactly pinpoint, then finding it in a telescope and aligning it is much easier than using any added. Wide angle, yeah. Even for like, if you have a lens, say suppose you have a 300 mm fixed lens to your camera and you attach it to a telescope, you find it and you can definitely try and get good photographs of some deep sky objects. Yeah, so this particular image has been taken at 250 mm and you can see here with the wrong shutter speed, or rather a little faster shutter speed, I can see it has been trailed, whereas this particular image has been taken where it is not trailed. So that is the idea. This has been tracked, this has not been tracked. So you can see the difference yourself what happens if there is no tracking. And it's not only about just tracking, it is about right amount of tracking, because due to some mechanical errors your tracking can go wrong and you can still end up getting trails after a certain duration of time. So there are different ways of tracking. One is of course the equatorial mount, which is one of the simplest ones, where you adjust your polar axis, you adjust this point it to your pole star, and simply it just goes around a RA axis. That is one way of tracking. Some few of the telescopes these days have this three stars tracking, where they actually identify three stars, you locate three stars, and then set the motor that based on the data of those three stars it will keep tracking. Of course here you need to have both axis motion, that is your azimuth and your altitude motion. And the third one, which generally ideas, I mean, generally a type of mount that even I started off was a barn door tracking mount, where we just had two planks, wooden planks, and this angle was adjusted to your latitude. And so this one is with a DC motor, but you can actually, if you carefully do it, we used to do like move the basically track it with hand. We had a shaft attached to it, and we used to slowly track it with and take images, see if there are any trails in the images. If yes, discard it, take another image. So initially all those things have been done, but yes, of course, you can attach a DC motor and simplify your life for that. So now it's about taking the images. Again, now there are multiple ways you can shoot an image. One is, of course, if you have really good tracker, then you can go for a single shot of long exposure, really long exposures of even hour or 2 hours, and really get good image. If you feel that your tracking system is not that accurate, then you can take images of shorter duration, and then the software will help you to stack and actually give you the same effect as you would be having for long exposure. So this, these are the two images. But of course, when I say it will give you the same effect, of the image quality is degraded a bit when it comes to stacking. So you can see it here itself, where a single shot of 8 minutes has been taken by David Lane. He's a very good astrophotographer, and you can see the difference in the Horsehead Nebula here and the one which I have taken at for the same exposure, but I have stacked frames. You can see this has become much more flatter than what it is here. So that happens when you try to stack images versus what you would get with a continuous tracking, a single shot with continuous tracking. So that those problems do occur, once you take images, it's not only about the images of the objects that you take, but along with it, you need to take two more images. That is, one is your dark frames and other is your flat frames. So dark frames is nothing but the thermally generated noise that you have when your sensors are not exposed to any light. So generally what you do is you keep your cap on the camera itself, or take the images with the same settings as you would take for the light images. And whatever you get is your thermally generated photons. Similarly, your sensors may not be really identical. I mean, all the pixels in your sensors may not be exactly identical. So you might end up getting images which are ideally uniformly illuminated, but what you get is some vignetting at the edges. Or even if there is some dust or some smudges on the lens itself, you might end up getting images which are not uniformly lit. You need to correct the flat frame. So what you do is you choose a patch of the sky or any patch which is entirely uniformly lit, take the images with the same ISO settings in this case, and then you do something like this. This is a general process. These days softwares help you do this, so you don't have to do it manually. So general idea is, yes, this is your raw image, this is your dark image, and this is your flat image. So you basically have an image, you subtract dark from the raw, then you subtract dark from the flat, and then divide the two, and what you get is basically still a raw image, unprocessed image, but with your dark and flat reduced. So this is the first thing that you need to do, and as I told you, most of the softwares do that these days, so you don't have to manually sit and do it. All you need to do is just take the right frames and upload it, and it will do it for you. Another thing is rotation of the earth. I've already spoken about it. So your softwares can actually help you align all the stars together and make a final image out of it. Or else, if you have less number of frames, or if you have infinite time with you, you can actually take each frame and manually align it in Photoshop. Even that can be done. But generally what I use is these two softwares, Deep Sky Stacker and Registack. So these are few screenshots that I've put out of Deep Sky Stacker. So it actually allows you to open your picture files, your dark files, flat files, and everything. And then it gives you option about how you want to stack, whether this is a standard mode where it will choose the frame out of all the images that you upload. And then there is an intersection mode where it will choose a small area, I mean basically the intersecting area and all the frames and so on, the various options that you can make use of while stacking. And there are two ways it stacks. Either it collects the timestamp data from your images and try to stack it depending on the speed of Earth's rotation, or another way is actually searches for common objects in all the images, common stars, and you can actually give your threshold, compute how many number of stars, it will find number of stars and it will tell you, and based on that, so now in this case it has found some, say, 207 stars. So based on these 207 stars, it will try to align all the objects. So more number of stars, your alignment is going to be, stacking is going to be better. And what you end up getting after stacking is a final image like this. Or of course, looking at it, you don't find anything in it. Now you have to take this image, open it in your processing tools, and then work on it. So again, processing for each image can be different. If it is a star cluster, then you have to actually make sure that your the stars need to look like point objects. So you have to make sure that they do not bloat a lot. Then if it is in some nebulosity, then generally stars go bad while processing when you are trying to process nebulosity. So you try to create different layers and process each thing separately. So that is known as masking. You mask different layers and you actually do the processing differently. For planets, it's an entirely different method. I'll come to planets a little later. So the first thing that you do generally after stacking is a general method. You can ask this to any astrophotographer. The first thing that you do is first adjust the levels of your image. So you open your image and simply adjust the levels. So your levels will actually change your tonal structure of your this. So this is a histogram of this particular image. So what you do is the shadow, the darkest point will be try and adjust it to the start of this histogram, which will actually give you something like this, which simply changes your contrast and your tone of your image. But you may find that the edges have become much more darker than what you need. So there is another way of reducing that is when you adjust levels. Generally in a Photoshop, your levels are created as another layer. So you can simply reduce the opacity of that layer, blend it as luminosity, and you can see the difference in the two images, that it has been reduced, the effect of leveling has been reduced. So that depends on how you want your image to look like. It's more about it's more dependent on your experience than there are no particular methods as such as to where you should, to what level you should adjust and stop. It depends on how you want your image to look, and basically experience from previous processing tools. Another way what you can do is if you feel that there is no data in the edges, then you can simply crop out the way which the area where you want to work more, so that it will reduce the vignetting effects that you see after adjusting the levels. And this image, of course, I've got from that image after playing along with these tools. So these tools are available in Photoshop. These are specifically meant for astro processing, and these tools are, so there are various, you can see there is a tool of reducing space noise reduction, then deep space noise reduction, and this particular tool that I frequently use is lightening DSO. So when I have images like this where I have stars as well as you know, some nebulosity around, then I generally use this where it actually lightens the DSO is deep sky objects, this nebulosity around, and it will dimmer the stars because I don't want the stars to bloat, like become bigger and bigger. So that is the tool I generally use, and it's not that you have to use it once, you have to literally play along, and again, as I told you, experience that counts. So you keep playing around. It's never the case that I have started working and in the first shot I have got all these images. So many times I have actually worked on the same image multiple times. I have set of processing, like sets made of been using different processing tools, and finally, whichever image I feel better out of 4 or 5 sets, I choose to finalize that. So there are different, and then again, sometimes these stars have these blue hollow around it, and here it's still looking fine, but in many of the images you may not like this hollow around. So there is even a tool which will actually reduce the bluish shade around it. And there are another ways. Say if you don't have these tools, there are another ways. What you can do is actually separate out your image in these three different channels, RGB channels, and work on each channel separately. So if you're talking about the red channel, then you can see these areas have been overexposed. So correct for them, work on these areas. Then you go to the green channel. You can see the difference in the green channel itself. Work in the green channel. Come to the blue channel where you will be actually working on the stars rather than the nebulosity. And then after you work on the three channels separately, you can again collapse them together, and you get whatever the final image is. This particular image I had shot 2 years ago from Badlapur for said nebula, and this has been taken at 400 mm focal length with some 8 minutes of exposure. So another thing that happens is, in the previous image, there was the image was just the sky photograph. There was no land object over there. But suppose you want to have, especially when you go for Milky Way, it is always that you take it along with some land objects. Okay, so once you try to stack a Milky Way, the land objects smudge like this, because obviously you try to align the stars, your land objects will blur out because of Earth's rotation. And but of course, if you try to process this image, you might make this region of the sky beautiful, but this looks really bad. I mean, that's not how you leave it. So what you generally do is, after processing, you choose one single frame of the total frames that you have taken for stacking, cut out basically the part, the land object that you have, and paste it onto the processed image. This is an unprocessed image still, or paste it onto this stacked image, and which paste it as a separate layer, and then you can work on both separately and then blend it together once you are done with processing of the both. So this actually gives you a good, this is basically to beautify your image, and you can see the effects. This one particular image I had taken from Neroy, where I had to actually work on the Milky Way separately, this house separately, and also the reflection of the Milky Way separately. So this I had actually made three different layers and processed each layer separately, and final outcome is what you can see. And this has been taken of 22nd frames, total 49 frames with ISO of 3200. Another object, why I am showing you this particularly, is because this part of the sky is generally not seen from Mumbai at all. The Perseus Arm is, I have never seen Perseus Arm from Mumbai ever. This has been taken at Raigad Fort. I have seen it only twice. So it's one of the dimmest, I mean, if you compare the Sagittarius Arm, you actually see it with naked eye. But Perseus Arm is never seen with naked eye unless it is really dark. The conditions need to be really dark. So this particular again requires, these type of images which are really faint requires dark skies, and you cannot really go from take images from Mumbai. So this is one, and again I repeat the images which has been taken. So now this will make much more sense than what I had shown previously. So you can see it has been, since of course this mount was tracking, so you can see I have gone for like around 1 minute shutter speed, and total 43 frames I have. So this particular image has been taken with an exposure of 43 minutes. Same thing for Andromeda, this has been taken with an exposure of 53 minutes. And then I come to planetary photography, which is entirely a different procedure. You do not take single shots. You can, of course, but you do not take single shots. You actually go for an HD video. So most of the DSLRs these days allow you to go for HD video. Then separate out the frames. You can either separate out in like a TIFF format or some, definitely not JPEG. So even actually some of the softwares actually allow to you to get out raw type frames out of your HD quality video. And then, but the tedious part is, no software is actually going to help you choose the right frames for stacking. This you have to do manually. So generally with a say a HD video of 1 minute or 1.5 minutes, you end up getting 3000 frames. All 3000 frames will not be good. Some of the image will be, some of the frames will be little blurred because it's a video and you're separating out the frames. So you have to sit, choose manually, roughly I go for 1000 frames. You have to manually choose 1000 frames and then stack them together and then process it. Okay, so it's really a tedious job when you go for planetary photography. So this particular image I had taken from NERA 3 years ago from an 8-inch telescope, where I had taken around 1000 frames and stacked in Registack. So Registack is another software for stacking, which is generally used for planetary or some extended objects, not deep sky objects. So here the idea is, you open all the frames and then it allows you to actually choose certain points on the image, on the one single frame, and then it will stack based on the number of points you choose. The more number of points you give, it's going to give going to do a better stacking. And similarly, I had taken Jupiter. This was just taken a month ago. Again, a place near Shirdi, and this is being taken from a 5-inch telescope with a 3x Barlow magnification. You can even do moon photography, but moon is one object that you don't require any tracking mount or anything at all. What you can do is simply, if you're steady enough to hold your camera without much of vibrations, then you can actually take, because you require very less low shutter speed for moon. So there is no question of any blurring effect in case of moon. Of course, a single shot of moon is good enough, but if you again go for stacking, say, to three images of moon, this has been taken at 6 frames, then you can actually get a good contrast between the craters and the lit up part, the bright part of the moon. And I have been talking about DSLRs so far. It's not that you cannot do astrophotography without a DSLR. This image is I had taken from way back in 2009-2010 with a simple point and shoot camera. These are the total and annular solar eclipse that happened in India from Varanasi and Kanyakumari. So it's not that you cannot do anything if you don't have a DSLR. You can definitely have such images. And the DSLR, the current point and shoots, I think, do give an exposure setting or the shutter speed setting up to 8 seconds or something. So even that can be used, of course, but you will not get the same quality as I've already mentioned as you get it in DSLR. And about manual stacking, comets are the most difficult object when it comes to stacking because none of the softwares actually help you stack comets well. There are few expensive softwares which will definitely help you do it, but I'm talking about the free softwares that you get, and none of the free softwares will allow you to stack comets that efficiently. So far, whatever comet photography I've done, I've stacked them manually. So these have been stacked manually as separate layers. 15 frames were stacked in Photoshop as separate layers and then blended together. And this again, this is a time lapse stacking where I do not try to align all the comets together, whereas I have stacked them as I have taken shots after some time delay, and you can see it actually traces the path of what it takes in the sky. So this has been taken at TIFR's C phase. This was taken in 2013. Sorry. Yeah. Oh, this is the bird. This is the bird. So this was comet Pan-STARRS, which was seen naked eye in March 2013. And coming back to the Milky Way again, which I had taken from TIFR C phase. So when I was taking this Milky Way, it was partially cloudy, and I took around 153 frames, 153 images, out of which to get this image, I stacked only 71 frames. The rest of the frames had clouds in it. So of course, you don't need to throw away those frames. So what you can do is actually create a time lapse like this where you can see the motion of the Milky Way and the clouds moving. So that's it. Thank you.
So thank you, Mustafa.
Thank you, sir.
Really taking us to a completely different world and using the simple cameras that we all know.
Sometimes you actually get a video with the satellite.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, with Jupiter, you actually get a video with the shadow of Io and all. We have actually shot that.
Okay.
With the shadow of Io moving on the surface of the Jupiter. So that we have done that.
Okay, I can see the cloud is moving from here to from your auditorium. Okay, Arnab,
one quick thing.
Yeah.
You should tell people, can you put this on your laptop?
As in? Oh yeah, one thing, yeah. So when I was talking about Deep Sky Stacker, of course you cannot use it on your laptop because it takes hours, literally hours to stack. So if I'm really going for 50 frames, I'll require minimum 8 hours to stack the frames. So what I generally do is, I come overnight from sky observation, then put it for stacking and then go off to sleep. That is what I generally do. But you need a desktop. You cannot really work with a laptop because it will heat up your processors and it can damage your laptop. So this thing is preferably done on a desktop than a laptop.
Okay. So I know you are such a great photographer and taken by one of our family members, Mayuresh Shambekar.
Okay.
I hope you will like it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. For
thank you, sir.
Excellent. Very good.
So it's basically the sensitivity of the
picture.